Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. We have a terrific show for you today. Media mergers are in the news, network neutrality rules by the FCC, threats to close off the funding for community and public radio and television. All sorts of news of media policy is hitting the headlines, and for good reason. Today we'll be talking about it with one of the leading activists on media policy in the United States, Craig Aaron, Managing Director of Free Press, will be our guest for the full hour here on Media Matters. So stay tuned. Have a great time with us today. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
A single media company now has unprecedented control over the flow of information in the United States. The Federal Communications Commission and the Department of Justice approved Comcast's deal to buy NBC Universal on Tuesday, creating a giant behemoth that combines the largest cable and internet provider with a huge broadcast network, with dozens of local NBC and Telemundo stations, movie studios, and online video portals. Casting the lone dissenting vote at the FCC, Commissioner Michael Copps wrote that the deal opens the door to the cableization of the open internet, the potential for walled gardens, content prioritization, and access fees to reach end users is now very real. Some conditions have been placed on Comcast to protect competition in the market and to ensure Comcast's newfound power doesn't lead to unfair advantages over its competitors, particularly online video providers. But most public interest groups say that the conditions won't really stop Comcast from doing what it wants. Free Press President Josh Silver warns that we'll all end up paying more for our media, whether we're Comcast subscribers or not. He says that the conditions won't last forever.
The problem with conditions is this. They are short-term and inherently designed to sunset over a number of years. In this case, 7 years. It's like getting married and your spouse saying, okay, I'll be true to you for 7 years, but after that, all bets are off. Same deal in this case. After 7 years, Comcast will be able to go ahead with their stated plans to create tiers on the internet, to hold back programming to some video providers and not others, and to monetize their undue market advantage to the greatest extent possible.
In a few years, all television and phone service will be delivered through a digital platform. And as these services become more commonplace, customers will abandon DSL internet service for high-speed cable.
The folks at Comcast know this, and they know they can wait 7 years and let all of this shake down. And then after 7 years, when the conditions applied to this merger expire, then they can have their way.
Silver predicts that in the next few years, the debate over the future of the internet is going to move toward the idea of competition policy.
And that is, simply put, am I going to have choices as to who gives me internet service, or am I stuck with cable because it's the only service that's fast enough to deliver high speed, high definition video and other high bandwidth applications? That's the fundamental question. And what we'll be seeing is much more focus on practical ways to apply competition policy that allows other competitors into markets across the country so that consumers have more choices.
A legacy community radio station in San Francisco that helped boost dozens of lesser-known musicians onto the national stage has gone quiet this week. In a complicated and hushed deal, the University of San Francisco sold the license for the eclectic student and volunteer-run KUSF to the University of Southern California for $3.75 million. Under the new agreement, KUSF will transfer to an online-only format as an all-classical music program previously heard on KDFC takes over its frequency. Although the deal has yet to be approved by the Federal Communications Commission, the university suddenly pulled the plug on the station at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, shocking the Bay Area. Nearly 500 students and community members gathered on Wednesday to protest the deal. The university claims the online format will be used as a teaching laboratory for students and will help KUSF grow a worldwide audience. Josh Wilson, program advisor for the Bay Area nonprofit Independent Arts and Media, a longtime ally of KUSF, worries that the online format will exclude people who don't have access to or can't afford a broadband connection or mobile device that can stream an internet-only radio station.
ditto goes for any local businesses or local venues that would be playing KUSF and underwriting on KUSF. They're going to have to spend extra money on an internet connection and the right technology to stream and pick up and broadcast that, and that's a quick avenue to just shutting down access to the station for the bulk of the community that would be making use of it.
Wilson was a DJ at KUSF from 1994 to 2002, interviewing an impressive lineup of musicians and authors, from Billy Bragg to Ursula Le Guin. He said both San Francisco and the nation are losing a legacy station.
You have to keep in mind that KUSF is part of a direct cultural lineage that started with the beatniks, continued with the hippies, picked up speed with the punks through the 70s and 80s, and carried on right through the golden age of raves and electronic music into the 90s and indie music in the present. That's all gone now.
Independent Arts and Media is considering how to fight the deal. To find out more, go to www.artsandmedia.net.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, January 23rd, 2011. And we have a great show today, I think, one I've been looking forward to doing and covering some issues I think that a lot of our listeners have been asking about. So we're going to cover a lot of what's been breaking in the news of media and media policy in the last several months. And to do so, we have as our guest today, Craig Aaron, the Managing Director of Free Press, the media reform and public interest group based in both Washington and Massachusetts. And I should add before we bring Craig on air that I was the co-founder of Free Press some 8 years ago and served as president of the organization until 2008. I remain on the board today, but my role in day-to-day operations and really any of the actions of the group now are very, very limited compared to ones they once were. Craig Aaron, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thanks so much, Bob. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, let's start right in. There's been so much happening, and I think the big story, and Media Minutes just covered it, and it was also covered before that and on the media here in WILL. Let's talk about the big merger between Comcast and NBC Universal. I think that our listeners are familiar with it, and I know Free Press took a very strong position on this. So why don't you just give the lay of the land, why this is an important issue, where Free Press came down, and what your take is on the government's decision?
Sure. Well, so this week, or I guess maybe we're now into last week, but the FCC and the Justice Department have signed off on one of the biggest media mergers in recent memory, a $30 billion deal uniting Comcast, which is already the nation's largest cable company, the nation's largest residential broadband provider, with all the holdings of NBC, including the broadcast network, more than two dozen local television stations, a couple dozen cable channels, Universal Studios, in total 125 different media properties being brought together under one umbrella as a result of this deal. And what really worries me about the outcome here is, of course, the concentration of too much media power in one company's hands. And this is really the new face of media consolidation, I think. I mean, I know you've spent a lot of time over the years on this program talking about the dangers of media consolidation, of course, writing about it as well. But this is something new, a new breed, because it'll have a company, the new Comcast, that will not only control an immense amount of content and content creation, which we've seen in various forms over the last few decades, but it combines that with the control over the pipes, with the gatekeeper power of deciding ultimately, how this content is going to be distributed on the internet, which other cable systems are going to have access to this content, and especially in communities where Comcast is becoming the only game in town controlling the internet, cable, and now a major broadcast outlet. I think it's a really harrowing prospect for the future of media. We've seen, of course, over the last 30 years and beyond, the disastrous impact of media consolidation on local communities, on local news gathering. And now we're, I fear, about to enter a whole new era of runaway media consolidation where we'll see not only Comcast, NBC, but how long will it be before Verizon or AT&T or Time Warner, again, decide that they need to start looking at Disney or CBS or other big content companies or other big internet companies, and that the benchmark set here by the Federal Communications Commission and to a lesser extent by the Justice Department is a very dangerous one. That precedent, if that were applied to future media deals, we could see most of what we watch, see, hear, and read every day fall into even fewer hands, which, frankly, it's almost hard to imagine.
Well, Craig Aaron, it seems that if you allow Comcast and NBC Universal, so finally we have the largest cable company in the country, which is the one of the largest ISPs, if not the largest broadband ISP in the country as well, now in a position where it takes over a broadcast network as well as one of the handful of major film studios with all the TV stations associated with it. How can the government at this point turn around and say, well, gee whiz, AT&T, you can't take over Disney or merge with Disney, or Verizon, you can't merge with Viacom or something? It seems like the horse is out of the barn here, isn't it?
Well, in some ways it certainly is. Now, part of our responsibility going forward and the public's responsibility, because unfortunately their regulators in Washington aren't doing the job, is going to be to really chronicle and watch what Comcast does and all those negative impacts, being able to make the case against these future deals. But there's no question it'll be an uphill climb. And we've seen this at every wave of media consolidation over the decades, that the failure of our leaders in Washington to recognize that this is a wave, that this isn't just one deal, and that their job isn't merely to look at whether this is a good business deal. In fact, it's not that at all. It's to measure whether an arrangement like this, a merger, a takeover, is in the public interest. Now, there's no way this is in the public interest, and you can read the 300 pages of the FCC put out approving this deal, and you'll see very little mention of the public interest and a real stretch to claim this is in the public interest. But you'll see almost no awareness, and certainly not from the leadership and the political leadership in Washington, of really the Pandora's box that they have opened here with this union of Comcast and NBC. Even if this deal falls apart for business reasons, and we've seen that time and again, AOL Time Warner being one of the most recent examples, where these deals get into trouble because these companies get so big, Tribune Company, another example, that they start to topple over. But even then, the destruction in terms of public discourse, in terms of newsrooms, that never gets reversed. So the impact on local news gathering, on the information that people receive, that never gets fixed, even if these deals from a business perspective, as they inevitably do, often prove disastrous.
Craig Aaron, as you're talking, I'm reminded how back in the 1990s, and even more recently, but especially a while back, all discussions of the new emerging digital era were about how we were going to have this plethora of viable choices, and the traditional media giants were all going to go under, and the telecom companies were all going to go under because there's going to be anyone could get online and compete, and we were going to have this competitive Valhalla. And it seems like we're almost in the exact opposite place. And what I'd like to ask you is, when I read the Wall Street Journal or the business press, the most fervent defenders of what's taking place, like the Comcast merger with NBC Universal, say, well, this is the free market. This is just how competition works in the free market, and the government can't interfere with that, or else it gunks up the efficient allocation of resources. You've probably heard that argument. What's your response?
Well, to sort of go back to basics, of course, what those articles always leave out, of course, is that we're going to have rules. And Comcast certainly spends as much or more than anybody else trying to craft policies and rules as long as those rules benefit them. So it's a little baffling to me to hear these sort of, free market purists talk about how great it is to see these combinations happen, when the actual effect of these deals is not only to really harm the free market, especially in the internet space, by giving so much power to these giant companies, but to harm the marketplace of ideas, to make it that much harder for independent voices, people that have something new or different to say, even just a great idea for a new business, that this is actually throwing up tremendous obstacles to the functioning of the free market. So it continues to baffle and confuse me at just how pervasive that myth is, and how many people have bought into this idea that there's simply nothing we can do about this kind of concentration of power when we see every day the negative impacts of that and really the harms to a real free market, a free market where anybody has the chance to thrive and succeed. That's not something that Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, or anybody else of that nature and size is interested in. They're interested in being gatekeepers, in controlling, in being the ones you have to go through to get information. And while I do not consider myself a conservative, I find it, frankly, very confusing how willing so many people who do consider themselves conservatives or even libertarians are to accept corporate control of their media, are to accept corporate domination of their media in a way that if the government would even, you know, get anywhere near it, seems like the worst thing imaginable.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Craig Aaron, the managing director of Free Press, the public interest media reform group based in both Massachusetts and Washington, D.C. We're talking about the Comcast-NBC Universal merger. We'll be talking about net neutrality, public media, other internet issues, all the stuff that's going on related to media policy that's taken place in Washington and around the nation. Our number here at Media Matters, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Craig Aaron, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And Craig Aaron, as you were just talking, I'm also reminded of the fact that, you know, Comcast is a company, is a cable company that built up its entire business model on getting monopoly licenses granted by the government to do cable service. It's not a company that came up in a competitive market where it competed with 13 other cable companies and won out. Its most important competition was getting a government license, having great lobbyists who knew how to get these licenses. And likewise on those lines, NBC is a company that's model was built upon getting government license, important government broadcast licenses in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and then building an empire on top of those.
Right. You privatize the public resources, and then when the public comes back saying, okay, well, we're ready for you to complete the other end of the bargain, then suddenly you scream how it's the free market and your corporate speech or whatever it is that's being limited. Now, again and again, and this merger is no exception, going into those deals, the companies always talk about, oh, they're going to offer such great public service and low-cost options, and they would never, ever interfere with the free flow of ideas. But all of that flowery language and pretty speech and things they put in the preamble of these deals, that never seems to materialize. What does materialize is even more media power, even more concentration, even more money flowing to these media giants, but our communities never seem to get the benefits of these deals. There aren't benefits for the public or the communities. That's supposed to be the job of the Federal Communications Commission to watch out for that, to prevent that from happening. But, of course, they don't seem very interested in doing that job anymore.
Well, Craig Aaron, you're close to the action there in Washington. You've been following this as closely as anyone. You know, I don't know if listeners to this show or anyone who's not been in the position you've been in right on the inside really has an understanding of just how large of a lobbying arsenal a company like Comcast has or NBC or General Electric has. When they swing into action on Capitol Hill or at the FCC, the sort of resources they bring to bear to get their way. Give a sense, if you will, what you've been up against and what Free Press and the other public interest groups have been up against in the last year on this merger.
Well, it's really remarkable, and I think when people think about lobbying in Washington, they think of big oil, they think of the big drug companies, but they forget about the immense lobbying power that media companies bring to the table. And there is, with the possible exception of the pharmaceutical industry, there is no bigger lobby in Washington. The number one company in lobbying and campaign contributions, AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, Time Warner, their trade associations, they're not far behind. And we looked at, I don't have all the 2010 numbers, but looking back at 2009, which is the most recent complete year I have, although we'll have the new one soon, you know, we saw just those big companies, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, Time Warner, and their main trade associations, they hired 500 lobbyists. So essentially a lobbyist for every member of Congress, and that's just what they report. So that doesn't include all the other former congressional staffers and members of Congress that are just sort of sitting back and maybe don't actually walk into the room to talk about specific legislation. We estimate to get this deal done that they spent at least $100 million to push through the Comcast deal to get dozens of members of Congress to speak out in support. It is an immense and powerful lobbying machine. Comcast certainly pulled out all the stops to push this deal. The other big phone and cable companies, too, are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to influence Washington. And it's remarkable, and I think if you haven't been here, and even if you have been in Washington, I've now been in Washington going on 8 years, you're almost constantly surprised at just how pervasive this lobbying power is, because it's not only the money that's reported and the meetings and the fundraisers and the events, but it is really, in many ways, the takeover of the decision makers. You can go to any office, even the most progressive member of Congress, if they're engaged on telecom issues, and you ask them to list the last 5 or 6 or 10 people who've held that key job of telecom staffer, and I guarantee you that 70 to 80% of them are now working for industry, either in the form of a big lobbying firm or one of these big companies. You can go to the FCC, again, even to the most progressive members of the Federal Communications Commission, Michael Copps, who you heard dissented against the Comcast merger. Go back through the list of his staff from as long as he's been there, and again, 70, 80, 90% of those people who were fighting for media democracy not long ago are now working for Comcast or AT&T or Verizon. So there is just an incredible amount of pressure, an incredible amount of momentum behind these companies, and they spend tremendous amounts of money to maintain that. So even when you have a company like Comcast, which in survey after survey literally ranks as the worst company in America, whose CEO has been called out for one of the most wasteful uses of shareholder money in terms of propping up his giant salary, even with all of that, all of the bad things Comcast has done over the years, a deal like this sails through almost unscathed so that Comcast can go out there and say, yeah, there's some conditions, but we're not worried about any of them. That's what they're telling their investors. They might have gone into the FCC screaming like, oh, this is going to be so onerous. But when they talk to the investors, they say, you know what, this is in the bag. Nothing to worry about.
Well, let's talk about those conditions, because when the deal was announced last week by the FCC and then immediately followed, it seemed like, by the Department of Justice Antitrust Division approving the deal, the news coverage had, in some cases, discussion of the conditions that were put in the deal that were forced upon Comcast and NBC Universal for the deal to go through. And in one broadcast on NPR, in fact, they had a member of public interest community from Washington who you work with, who was actually really touting these as legitimate conditions that are really putting some muscle into the deal. What's your sense of how important these conditions are? I guess you've given us your answer already,
right.
But,
well, no, but
elaborate on it.
I think it's important to talk about the conditions, because there are conditions there, and some of them are, on balance, good things. So things that I would rather have than not have. But including some limits on what the new company can do with the online video maker Hulu, and some guarantees about how they would treat content as it's going online, which are partly dependent on what other big companies do, but they're not nothing. There's some increased commitments, although it really works out to about 20 minutes a day in terms of news coverage on certain stations, including, I guess, 6 of the 16 Spanish-language stations. I'm not sure what happens if you're in one of the 10 markets that doesn't get news. I guess you just get nothing. But there are some things in the deal, little details. They're going to provide $9.99 broadband to low-income communities in certain places. You know, these are all perfectly fine things, and they're good in and of themselves, but what they aren't is any kind of counterweight to what this deal would represent, and what they also aren't is anything that a company like Comcast, or NBC for that matter, shouldn't have been doing anyway.
And not to be a cynic here, but looking at history, if there's anything here that they really want to get rid of, they can just pretty much blow it off, and their lobbyists can clear any space for them in Washington, can't they?
Well, that's absolutely right. And so, first of all, all these things expire. So they did manage, and I think I might credit Commissioner Clyburn, who did vote for the merger, with some of these carry on for 7 years, which isn't nothing. 7 years is a decent amount of time. But the requirements are so minuscule and minor and really largely meaningless in the scope of this massive deal that it's almost like nothing, and that's how Comcast is treating them. Furthermore, the fact that the FCC and the FCC chairman in particular really rolled over here in this deal and offered almost no resistance to Comcast, in fact, treated his job like it was to shepherd this merger through, not to make sure the public interest was being respected. If I'm Comcast or any other company planning to do a mega merger in the future, I've now gotten the clear signal that they're not really going to do anything to stand in our way. Because imagine the political situation that this merger, we had a really hot issue in net neutrality, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but one had been going on for years, was supposed to be the hallmark of the Obama administration. We have the national broadband thing, all these things the FCC was supposed to do, and here we have a company like Comcast, a notorious bad actor, wanting to get their deal done. Now, most of us in that situation would look at that as, well, there's a real political opportunity. You know, here's a giant company that needs something, and there's a lot of things that we want to stop them from doing. But the FCC, the way they approached this deal, was as if this merger was happening almost in a complete vacuum, separate from any other political question, any other issue facing the FCC, and hardly put any demands on them. So when you're looking at that, if you're one of these companies and you want to go back and say, well, you know what, we're kind of done with $9.99 broadband, or we're not going to make that $9.99 broadband include any of this great new products and services we're rolling out, you're not really going to worry about it because the FCC has been proven unable to stop you even when they had leverage and they had power. You know, it'd be pretty easy for you to just wait out a changing of the guard at the FCC, or maybe you don't even need to do that, to just start violating at will. And by and large, that's what we've seen happen in these deals, unless there were active regulators or immense amounts of public pressure trying to keep these companies honest. And now, clearly, we're only left with immense amounts of public pressure because the regulators, at least the ones that are in there now, with the notable exception, I think, of Commissioner Copps in this deal, they've proven unwilling to stand up to a company like Comcast, even when it is very clear that this deal is going to be harmful to the free flow of information and to the amount of choices we have out there as consumers. We're all going to be paying for this, and we're all going to see the diminishing returns that a deal like this offers.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Craig Aaron, the managing director of Free Press. He's been at Free Press for many years, and before that was an editor of In These Times, the newspaper or news magazine based in Chicago, and a graduate of Northwestern University's fine school of journalism. So you've got your Illinois roots in you, Craig.
Bears?
Well, there you are. I guess do we have to have an equal opportunity now? Fairness doctrine apply on that? Equal time? I don't think so. Not in Illinois.
There's no fairness, Dr. Bob.
Craig Aaron, if you want to call in to talk with him here at Media Matters, the number again, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. I want to add before we get back to our guests and to any callers that today is the birthday of our producer, Melissa Trentz, who's been doing the job so wonderfully now for us and is making this show possible. So happy birthday, Melissa. Working on your birthday, no less, today. It's been great having you with us. Look forward to a long run and have a great day today. Craig Aaron, one last thing on the Comcast NBC I want to get to, then I want to move on to net neutrality and a number of other issues. But, this Telemundo is part of the deal, the Spanish language stations that will be part of this empire. You know, one of the great issues that's taken place beneath the radar for the most part, except in certain communities that are well aware of it, has been the sharp decline in minority and women ownership of broadcast and cable media in the United States in the last two decades. And, you know, where does this fit into what's going on with all these mergers? What is being done to address, you know, the plummeting numbers of minority groups or individuals from minority groups who own radio and television stations?
Well, I mean, the short answer is basically nothing is being done, that there were some proactive policies in the 1970s and 1980s where we saw a significant uptick in ownership, but the overall numbers are really pretty shocking. I mean, people of color... it's been a little while since I've looked at these numbers exactly, but I believe it's only about 3.5% of television licenses are held by people of color. About 5% are women. On the radio side, about 5% women and people of color that own radio licenses. And that's a pretty shocking number when you look at the actual demographic makeup of this country. I mean, starting with the fact that, of course, close to 51% women, but a third of this country is people of color and growing very fast, and yet they are not represented in terms of people who own television and radio stations, and it goes all the way down the line in terms of formats, in terms of management at these stations, et cetera, et cetera. One of the real failures of the Federal Communications Commission has been to address this even in the most symbolic ways. They've just completely failed, let alone the practical ways, like actually keeping accurate data, which, frankly, Free Press was one of the first groups, or I think the first group, to actually make an accurate accounting of ownership. We did that on our own. The FCC had failed to do it. We used their data, but they'd never bothered to add it up. So I think you look at this deal, and again, the FCC has its limits. A lot of the power to do things, you know, from sort of an affirmative action perspective has been taken away, but there are lots of things they could do to encourage divestments and local ownership, reward companies that are selling off stations for actually bringing them back to local communities. There have been great programs in the past to do that. Those have been gutted or abandoned. And so this deal just continues that. I mean, these stations were already owned by NBC. We've already seen cutbacks at these stations in terms of the news product. The things that Comcast is promising to do are completely unenforceable and really a pittance compared to the larger problem. And yet a lot of the energy that Comcast spent, to be frank, to push through this deal was in striking deals on the side with the major civil rights organizations in Washington to endorse these mergers in exchange for really unenforceable commitments to try to do better. I mean, when the head of NBC went to Congress to testify about this merger, and Maxine Waters from California asked him to name a show on NBC that was targeted at communities of color, he couldn't do it. And part of the reason he couldn't do it is because there wasn't one. So, I mean, this kind of shows you what we're dealing with. And so here's a huge portion of our population completely being underserved or unserved by a merger like this, and yet a lot of the groups who purport to represent those communities in Washington were very quick to sign off and endorse this deal for you know, commitments that are barely worth the paper that they're written on. So I think there's great reasons to be concerned about how consolidation is only going to worsen that, and real concerns about who's actually looking out in Washington for communities of color in these deals, because it seems that many of the groups are happy to sort of send in letters and endorse a deal like this, but are they going to be there? And I hope they will. I truly do. I hope that a lot of people who did sign up in this deal will hold Comcast's feet to the fire here and make sure that they deliver on the promises they made. But if past mergers are any indication, those promises tend to go out the door as soon as the deals are consummated.
Well, our guest today here on Media Matters is Craig Aaron. You've just been listening to. Let's go to the phone lines now and take a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently. Let's start with line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Craig Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been following the merger somewhat closely, and I've been especially concerned about avenues for internet distribution for independent cinema producers. And I know that Michael Copps has voiced concern about the merger, especially because of what he calls the cableization of the internet, that the distribution avenues will be turned into oligarchic control. So I was surprised to see that the Independent Film and Television Alliance ended up signing off on this deal and supporting it. And I'm wondering, I assume that they had some sort of concessions made to them, but I'm wondering what those were and what your opinion is on their support and their ultimate position on this.
Thank you very much, caller. Craig Aaron?
That's a great question, and I apologize because I don't have the details. I remember when the filmmakers did sign off on this deal, and they did negotiate for a certain amount of investment and some programming hours, I believe, with Comcast and NBC, but I don't know exactly what they got. I think there was a calculation there that this deal was going through, and they were going to get what they could. I think that's a very disappointing conclusion, and I think others, like the Writers Guild, for example, put up much more of a fight on this merger for all of the reasons that you describe. I think this deal is especially harrowing for the future of independent content, especially but not exclusively film on the internet, because it is going to give Comcast so much power, you know, over you know what gets on the internet, what of course gets on cable TV. And they have a lot of incentive to try to favor or discriminate in favor of their own content or content produced by corporate partners they've cut a deal with. And those deals are simply not going to be made available to to independent filmmakers. And one of the great things about the free and open internet is, of course, that you can go online, do whatever you want, go wherever you want, download whatever you want. So if you're someone making creative content, you have just as much a chance as anybody else to find that audience. That is not the kind of thing Comcast is interested in. And if they don't have a cut in it, they're going to make it much harder to find. Now, there are some stipulations in the deal that involve Comcast's having to give up some editorial control on Hulu, things like that. But most of those arrangements are done to sort of keep them from messing with other big content companies. And I don't think there's nearly enough protection for independent media makers. And I think that's exactly who Comcast in many ways is going to be targeting in the future, because they like an internet that looks like cable TV, where they pick and choose the channels for you, they push their content, they promote the things that they've been paid to promote or that they have a stake in, and if they can turn eyeballs away from other content, if they can make it harder to find, they're going to do that in every way possible. And I think that will be ultimately one of the things that we really lose in this deal. And I don't think filmmakers got in exchange for signing off or not opposing this deal or anything put into the conditions is really going to provide enough protection. And I think, you know, this just makes it harder for independent content makers at a time when we have the technology, frankly, where those obstacles should no longer be there. And whoever's making the best or most interesting content should be able to get it out there and find as big an audience as possible.
I should add before we go to our next caller that Michael Copps, the FCC commissioner that Craig Aaron has referred to several times already during the program, will be a guest here on Media Matters in 1, 2, 3 weeks, February 13th, for the full hour. So be sure to tune in then and we can talk to him about these issues and much more as he ends his second five-year term on the FCC this year. Let's go back to the phone lines now and go to Lafayette, Indiana, line 4. You're on the air with Craig Aaron.
Hello. That next one with Michael Cox will be incredible if you got enough people to stand up against him. I was wondering about sort of on the ground. You've been talking about content control, basically, and in some ways that's extremely important. But for people who just want to turn on and watch something cable and stuff, are we expecting higher prices and, say, a more division of labor, that there's going to be more layers of prices for you to get what you're after? Do you have any hint on what they're got up their sleeves on that sort of thing? And if so, is there ways in the law to go after those decisions? Or is that something they just put aside as business decision? That's the way it goes. Thanks.
It's a great question, and in some ways we should have started there, because that's how this is going to affect literally everybody. Whether or not you are a Comcast subscriber, you are going to pay more per month because of this deal. Because Comcast is going to, again, have so much control over content that they are going to be able to raise prices on their competitors, other cable systems, other content producers. They're going to be charging a premium for what they're bringing. And these are channels that people want, MSNBC, CNBC, Bravo, USA, core channels that if Comcast raises the prices for these channels that any cable subscriber expects, it doesn't cost Comcast any extra. They're just moving money from one pocket to another. But it will cost other companies more, and so you'll see prices go up. And then, I mean, of course, it's no secret that cable television subscription prices only move in one direction, unlike things you would see in what we're talking about in a free market. And when it comes to cable TV, they only move up and up some more. And some markets have already seen hikes of 50%, and we're going to see those again. That's what Comcast is interested in. That unquestionably will be the outcome of this deal. I think anything they can do in sort of complicated tier pricing, they're going to do that as well. That's the way these companies work. Any way they can hide charges, hide fees, make it harder. Now, it never goes, remember, in the other direction. If you only want 20 channels, you can't get to only 20 channels. If you only want 5 channels, not available. But they're very happy to put things on tiers that you want that make it that much harder to find. And, of course, they'll do everything they can to move content that they don't own a piece of up into the furthest and farthest reaches of those tiers, making it not only cost you more, but making it that much harder to find. So, unfortunately, I wish I had better news to offer in this regard, but I think one of the undeniable impacts of this is going to be higher prices for consumers. I think we'll start to see those very soon. And, you know, a non-toothless FCC, certainly that should be something they should be looking at, something Congress should be looking at in the current political climate and with the current makeup of the FCC. I unfortunately don't see them working to rein in those prices or do what we really need, which is increased competition. The reason those prices only go up in one direction is that they don't face any real competition. The cable companies don't compete against each other. They all enjoy local monopolies. And the phone companies, who have gotten into that business a little bit and in theory would provide competition, have been indicating that they're pretty much done. They're going to build out in some wealthy neighborhoods where they can find people willing to pay $100 a month for their super high-speed services. But as for the rest of us, sorry, Wall Street doesn't seem to think that's a good idea.
Well, let's go, Craig Aaron, now to the other big story and talk about that, which is net neutrality. And if you could just give a brief description of what that means for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with it, why it's important, and then, you know, what the FCC voted on to pass in terms of net neutrality in December.
Sure. Well, net neutrality, and we have mentioned it a couple times and probably should define it, it's just a fundamental principle that's been part of the Internet since its inception. And net neutrality is what ensures when you go online, you can go wherever you want, do whatever you want, download whatever you want, and it is not up to your service provider, your phone or your cable company, to decide which websites are going to work and which aren't. Net neutrality simply means no discrimination, and it's incredibly important. It's been at the center of what has made the Internet really and truly and hopefully will continue to be an unrivaled source of free speech, of democratic participation, and economic innovation. That's been because of net neutrality, because it pushes the innovation to the edges and ensures that anybody with a good idea, a new product, a new service, a new application has just as much chance as anybody else to find that audience and succeed. Of course, because of that incredible potential, where any website could have the reach of a television or radio station, could have the reach of the biggest companies, this has been something that the big phone and cable companies have been trying to get rid of, because they don't like that free and open model. They like the cable TV model, which we were just talking about, where they pick and choose the channels for you, and they decide which sites and services and applications get the best service. So this has been a very heated debate. I'm sure we've talked about it on this show a number of times and some others. That has been going on really in force since at least 2006.
And if I can interrupt you for 1 second, Craig Aaron, if during the presidential campaign, all the Democratic candidates for the nomination, the Democratic Party, were emphatic for network neutrality. This was an unabridgeable principle. And none was more emphatic in that regard than Barack Obama, who maintained that emphasis India's presidency whenever asked about the subject.
And this is one of the amazing things about this fight, and I mean, something that I think, you know, media activists should be very proud of, is we took an issue called net neutrality. I mean, what is that? Completely obscure. I mean, I remember Arianna Huffington mocking it as, you know, what is that, a Swiss tennis match? You know, this very complicated idea, and it became really a populist political issue where millions of people were contacting the FCC and Congress, where because of online activism and offline activism, a Republican effort back in 2006 to undo net neutrality forever was defeated. They failed to move the legislation, and this activism really surprised these big companies. It threw them off guard, and a lot of Democrats who came into office in the previous two election cycles, net neutrality became even a signature issue. It was the top of President Obama's technology platform. He gave a speech promising to take a backseat to no one on this issue, and to his credit, although you will get to the problems in a second, In office, as President of the United States, on multiple occasions, Barack Obama used the bully pulpit to talk about the importance of net neutrality, did not waver in that commitment. So a lot of people, millions and millions of people who have been fighting for this issue, had reason to believe that the FCC was going to deliver on that pledge, and they especially had reason to do it because Julius Genachowski, the chairman of the FCC, gave a huge speech in 2009 at the Brookings Institution saying, I'm going to deliver on that promise. I'm going to do net neutrality. But what we saw happen was that once the FCC started issuing rules, we started to see the compromises and the pressure. So that huge lobbying juggernaut that we talked about with Comcast, which also, of course, includes AT&T and Verizon and all the rest, they were surprised in 2006. They were wary at the beginning of the Obama administration that they were going to do something. But when they saw them start to waver, they really unleashed a lobbying onslaught. It had many dimensions. They've funded right-wing attacks on groups like Free Press, saying that, you know, they were socialists and whatever else Glenn Beck was talking about. Those were sponsored by AT&T, unquestionably. They got members of Congress to sign letters to the FCC criticizing what the FCC was doing. And now, of course, many members who signed those letters, if you called them and said, hey, why did you sign this letter? They would say, oh, I'm for broadband. I want to get more broadband in my community. That's the letter they thought they signed, but that letter was being used to oppose anything the FCC was going to do. And what we saw happen at the FCC is they started to back away, they started to retreat, they started to compromise. So they gave a big speech saying we're going to do net neutrality, then they started to back away. They issued some rules that were pretty good, pretty close to net neutrality, and instead of building and improving on those, they started to whittle away at them. There was a big court case, maybe we'll talk about that in a second, that made things more complicated at the FCC. The FCC proposed how they were going to deal with it, and then they started backing away to the point where by last summer, instead of going out in the public and raising noise about net neutrality and tapping into this great public support for this issue, instead they started having closed-door meetings with the biggest internet companies, the biggest cable and phone companies, to try to cut a secret deal. We were able to expose those meetings, but the impact was that the range of what was possible kept getting more narrow, more contained, to the point where here before the end of the year, the FCC voted along party lines for net neutrality rules that barely resemble real net neutrality. I would call these fake net neutrality or half net neutrality. And without getting too lost in the weeds, some of the important things to know is there are a few good things. There's some transparency in there. There's some protections against direct blocking of websites. There's some things that would take place on your wired, your home broadband connection where you will be able to continue to have at least the internet experience you have today, much of it. But the problem with what the FCC did is on the things that are coming in the future. The FCC completely failed to protect wireless connections, that is, connections you would get from a cell phone or a mobile device like an iPad or whatever great new things they come up with next. In fact, they essentially endorsed discrimination, saying that these big mobile phone carriers were free to discriminate. They were free to pick and choose not which websites, but which services and applications worked and which didn't. So there's nothing preventing them from making a deal with YouTube to provide video, but not doing Hulu or not doing that independent content we were just talking about. There's nothing to stop them from starting a streaming service with Clear Channel, but excluding the NPR service. There's nothing to stop them from doing that anymore. That's a huge loophole and a huge problem. It's not the only one. It is the biggest problem with what the FCC.
Yeah, well, Craig Aaron, let's pursue that problem a little further, because I think that is the you know, it gets to the heart of the future of the internet, which is increasingly the internet, especially for people under the age of, say, 25 or 30, and anyone who has a teenage daughter like I do knows how this is going. The future of the internet is largely going to be through wireless handheld devices to expand the telephones. You know, my youngest daughter lives on hers, barely uses the traditional World Wide Web and a landline computer anymore, except rarely. But for her and her generation and millions of Americans, it's increasingly a wireless experience. It's the internet. And that world is not going to have net neutrality. That world is not going to have access to anything you want at any time, but it will be a cable TV world where the telephone companies that have taken it over, basically Verizon and AT&T, dominate it. It's almost a national duopoly. They will be able to pick what you have access to and keep stuff off that they don't want you to have because they can't make money off it.
Well, that's absolutely right, and that is literally their business model. If you go to the trade shows, if you listen to the investor calls, that's what they're talking about. People are marketing technology, you know, what's called deep packet inspection technology, where they want to nickel and dime you on everything you do. So you get that phone, and you go to Facebook, and they want to dock your account a couple things. If you want to use Skype, or, you know, from their perspective, God forbid, Netflix, you know, they're gonna charge you even more. They want to try to take it down to that granular level where they're monitoring and monetizing every single thing you do online. That's never been the way the internet has worked. But what the FCC has done with this net neutrality rule is they've opened the door to essentially two internets. One you can maybe still get at your home office connection or your work connection, where you can get to most of what's available online, and a completely different experience for these wireless devices that are the future. And that's why companies like AT&T signed off, even in a lukewarm matter perhaps, but they signed off on what the FCC was doing. In fact, in many ways, they wrote the language of what the FCC is doing, because they see that in the future, it's not about the website. It's not about going to the homepage. I mean, even those of us who aren't, you know, teenagers, our online experience is not so much about searching out and finding websites anymore. We might go, we still visit websites, but it's all about the information being pushed to you. It's all about streaming media. It's all about video. And that is what they've opened the door to be able to discriminate, to be able to pick and choose. And they're claiming, you know, cellular phones are different and the networks are different. And even if that's true today, and I think that's arguable, and they certainly don't need to be able to discriminate on an economic basis, it's not going to be true in the future. And what's going to happen is they're actually going to cut off one of our best chances for competition and lower prices, because as you mentioned, the same companies that control those wired connections are also the dominant players when it comes to the wireless space, and they want to make sure you're still paying two bills a month. So when they control 60 or 70% of the market, you can throw in the other two big companies, it's 90% of the market, there aren't very many choices for people. And that's not the only thing wrong with these rules, but it's the worst thing. And even in the wired connection, though, the language is not what it could be. They even frown on some bad behavior. I think frown is the right word, because they didn't actually put it in the rules to prevent things like paid prioritization, allowing these phone and cable companies to essentially set up fast lanes and slow lanes on the internet.
Well, let's be honest, Craig, something that apparently isn't done very often in Washington. If you have a huge burgeoning wireless role that's not protective of net neutrality, it's proprietary, where these companies control it, it's not going to be very long till the cable companies with their broadband going into the home, Verizon in this case, Comcast in particular, is going to say to the FCC, hey, no fair, we can't compete with these guys if they can play by those rules, and then they're going to basically be able to bend it to their advantage. You know, you aren't going to have two separate worlds for very long.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and we saw that happen. I mean, that's how this whole net neutrality mess was created in the first place, is that when cable wanted to get into the broadband business, they'd always been regulated differently from phone companies, and so they petitioned the FCC to say, hey, we've had this really successful common carrier policy that's created lots of competition, lower prices, and people have, you know, dozens of choices for their dial-up provider, but we're the cable company. We don't like that model. We don't want competition. We don't want to share our wires. You need to let us out from under that, and after it wended its way through the courts, that's exactly what happened, and then the phone companies came and said, well, wait a minute, the cable company doesn't have to do this. Why should we face the burden of having that? So I think you are going to see that happen again, but you're also seeing a convergence where cable, so you've got the phone companies trying to basically keep everything down so that you don't get great service on wireless that they don't control. They're reducing their investment in the wired connection, and cable is increasingly, for most Americans, becoming the only game in town. So you have this new incredibly powerful cable monopoly and this new increasingly powerful and concentrated wireless monopoly, and that's sort of how it's shaping up whatever competition there would be. That's going to be a disaster for Internet users. It's very, very clear how that's taking shape. So there's not a lot of great things, and that's why this net neutrality rule was so important to just have. I mean, net neutrality, if you listen to the Republicans in Congress or the Republicans on the FCC, you know, they'll act like it's the most onerous regulation in history. But net neutrality itself, we have to remember, net neutrality itself is a compromise. Net neutrality is the most baseline, basic protections that are really only needed because we have so little competition, so few choices, that if all of the major carriers say we're going to discriminate, there's nowhere else for consumers to turn. That's why we need net neutrality. But in the rest of the world, in the places where they're rolling out internet service that's 50 times faster than what we get here, and they're paying half as much for it, they don't have the same kind of problems because they actually have competition policy and you actually have choices. So we're going so completely in the wrong direction, it's almost unfathomable. And what the FCC produced was a compromise on a compromise on a compromise on a compromise. And yet even that, these watered-down, weak rules, very easily could be thrown out in court because the FCC failed to do the most basic thing.
Yeah, let me set up what you're about to say, because this is the point I do want to get to without getting deep in the weeds, is that the FCC created this entire problem constitutionally and legally by a huge mistake, in your view, I think,
That's right.
It made. And one that could just, with a flip of a switch, rectify immediately, couldn't it? Explain what I'm talking about.
Yeah, sure. So what happened is what I was just talking about. When the cable companies wanted to get in the broadband business, the way the Communications Act, not to get too lost in the weeds here, but your audience is ready for it, I think. The way the Communications Act was written and then rewritten in 1996, it divides the law into different things. So there's a section for long-distance telephone service, and there's a section for traditional phone telecommunications service. There's one for cable TV, all different parts of the law. But, of course, that's all converging. So when the cable companies that were regulated under one part of the law got into the broadband business, they said we don't want the rules that apply to telecommunications services, even though the service we're providing is obviously a telecommunications service.
Meaning the telephone companies.
Right, exactly. So the Bush administration said, okay, cable companies, we're going to go with you, and we're going to, instead of treating broadband internet service the way we did dial-up internet service, which is that as a telecommunications service, we're going to create a new definition called an information service. And so we're going to lump it in with sort of websites and content and things, and it's a much less regulatory from their perspective. We're going to do that. And there was a court case that went all the way to the Supreme Court called the Brand X case, where the Supreme Court essentially said, well, we don't know whether that's a good idea, but it's up to the FCC to decide. So the FCC has this power, and they say, okay, we're going to change the way we regulate broadband. And then the phone company said, well, wait a minute. If cable broadband is not a telecommunications service, then we don't want to be a telecommunications service either. So they said, okay, telecommunications companies, now you're an information service. But they said, we're going to still try to police the internet through what we call ancillary authority. In fact, so it's sort of like it's extended out from our larger mission. And so then this actually got tested. Comcast was caught illegally blocking internet traffic. They were interfering with lawful file sharing using something called BitTorrent. They got caught because there was a guy named Rob Topolsky who was a computer engineer who happened to have a hankering for barbershop quartet music. He tried to share it with his friends. He discovered that Comcast was cutting off his connection. That's the short version. There was an investigation. The FCC, under a Republican administration, launched an investigation, ultimately finding that, yes, indeed, Comcast had been illegally blocking internet traffic, and they sanctioned them. Now, they didn't fine them. They just said, you have to stop what you're doing, and you have to come clean about how you were doing it. So Comcast said, that's too much. We're going to sue you. We're going to sue you, arguing that you don't even have the authority to sanction us as the Federal Communications Commission for blocking communications. And they won their case. And the reason they won their case goes back to the original sin, which was that the FCC gave up its own authority.
And the FCC could reclaim that authority. Isn't that right, Craig?
They can reclaim it, exactly.
At any time.
The Supreme Court has said it's up to the FCC. So the current FCC was faced with this major loss in a court case, throwing their whole agenda, because it's not just net neutrality. It's the ability to reform universal service. It's the ability to carry out the national broadband plan. It's anything to rein in these broadband providers. And so the obvious choice was for the FCC to say, okay, well, clearly this goofy information service approach doesn't work. And it so clearly doesn't work that the courts have rejected it. But that's okay, because we have this foundational policy called Title II, or the telecommunications part of the Communications Act. We can just go ahead and put broadband back where it always was until 2002. We'll just treat it there, and then we can decide which rules apply and which don't. But that clearly makes sense, gives us a chance to protect consumers, gives us a chance to encourage competition. But, of course, there's nothing scarier to a phone or cable company than the FCC actually being able to carry out competition policy. So they fought it like crazy, and they got every single Republican in Congress, 70 Democrats in Congress, to sign a letter saying, don't do this, whatever you do, it's an overreach, to go back to the rules we always had that worked and created competition. But that was considered a massive overreach. So the FCC said, no, we're going to do it. Then they said, well, we're not going to do it exactly. We've come up with what we call a third way. And those of you who followed any Democratic politics always know you're in trouble when the third way comes out. But the third way, which was going to be, we're going to do it, but we're going to immediately promise you all these things we won't do that you might perceive as regulatory. So they got to that compromise, but even that wasn't enough for these companies. So the FCC chairman then decided, it's too politically difficult, and I'm too afraid of the Republicans and the Democrats in Congress saying bad things about me, so I'm going to just completely abandon this approach. And so what they did in these net neutrality rules, the other huge glaring hole in these net neutrality rules, is they actually rest them on very similar legal arguments to the ones that the courts have already rejected.
Well, Craig Aaron, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. Just real quickly, people want to learn more about Free Press, learn more about these issues. Where should they go?
Freepress.net. If you're curious about net neutrality, savetheinternet.com, where you can learn all about why Verizon is already suing the FCC to undo these already watered-down rules.
Well, Craig
Lots
Aaron,
of information there.
I want to thank you so much for taking time from your Sunday to join us, from your family. Give my best to the wife and child.
Will do. Thanks, Bob.
And I want to thank Kyle Krohoff, engineer, and the birthday girl, Melissa Trentz, for being my producer, for all her great work. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back in 167 hours with Jen Posner talking about reality television, the guilty pleasure. Until then, everyone, have a great week.